last week we bounced around a lot at various scriptures, but today we're going to stick closer more just in one passage that we sort of started last week. And we're going to be looking at Jesus going to his hometown and that Jesus challenged their local perceptions. Before Christine and I were married, before I'd even asked her to marry me, I had taken her with me back to the United States so she could get to meet my parents, that my parents could meet her. I thought that was important for them to get to know each other a bit so she could see where I grew up, my hometown, the school I went to, some of that to have a better understanding of who I was. And while we were there, I got to visit the church that I had been a part of, the church where I prayed to accept Jesus, the church where I'd been filled with the Holy Spirit, the church where I'd really got a heart to love getting to play guitar and started getting to play some worship music, the place where, for me, I got interested in getting to do missions and traveling around the world and telling people about Jesus. That place had meant a whole lot to me. But because of some things through the years, there was a lot of leadership instability in that church. There was instability among the people. There was financial instability. And the church just wasn't doing so very well. And I remember being there, and they were having a meeting of these various pastors from around the city. It was kind of an interdenominational meeting, and just to share and encourage each other. But honestly, I remember it being almost depressing. Not depressing, but instead of having this excitement and life and vibrancy that I remembered from when I was there, it seemed like everyone had this, it's really hard getting to work in the city, and we believe God is going to do something, and we're just going to work hard. And when I was there was one of the first times, or probably the first time, that I thought about this chapter in a different way, of seeing Jesus walking into his hometown. And it wasn't really that I was homesick, but I was heartsick to see what, for me, had made such a huge difference in my life. And then it seemed like the people, there wasn't an openness. And there wasn't that fruitfulness and that joy and that life that had been there in quite the same way. So we're going to look at the place Jesus was from, Nazareth. Well, we'll start a little bit bigger in the area of Galilee, because we saw that there's the area of Judea and then Samaria and Galilee. And Jesus was from this area of Galilee that is approximately the size of North Brabant. If you are good with geography, it's about that big. And there were 3 million people who were living in this area, or at least according to the historian Josephus, that was his estimate. Maybe he was a bit high, but it was a very, very full place. Not only were there a lot of people, but it was known as a very fertile land. It was a great place to grow stuff. There was an old saying at the time, I guess, that it was easier to raise 10 tons of fruit in Galilee than one child, because there's so much fertility in the ground where you could grow a lot. So Jesus is from this area where it's highly populated, it's fairly large, but then the city itself was not. Jesus came from a place called Nazareth, and it had approximately 300 people at the time. More or less, there were just a whole bunch of extended families that were in this small village. It was about 10 acres. If you want to do a kilometer squared, the city of Maastricht is about 60 kilometers squared. The city of Nazareth was less than 1/10 of a kilometer squared. Nazareth was not a big place. The small bunch of people living together, probably many of them were extended families that are close together. The settlement itself had started around the 2nd century BC. See, at the time, Galilee had become known as Galilee of the Gentiles. That was even hundreds of years before the prophet Isaiah said it, where because of people that had invaded Israel and then people moved out from Israel and people that had moved back in, there are a bunch of people who are not Jewish heritage living in Galilee. And so there started becoming these Jewish pockets, these settler towns like Nazareth, where they were very conservative, all-Jewish communities, so that they're very kind of inward-looking, and they're wanting to displace all of these other people that are on their land that they would like to get out. The kind of people that would have lived there were poor. Probably all of them were peasants. No one's the rich one that's showing off. It's a small town that it didn't have any paved roads. It probably didn't have any federal buildings. I mean, if we looked at it today, it'd be the kind of place that doesn't have a gas station, doesn't have a movie theater, doesn't have a Gemeente house. It's just this kind of small area. In bad English, we would call it Podunk Galilee. Podunk just means there's nothing that is going on there. And they're probably hardworking people that, honestly, they just want to be able to provide a better life for their kids after them. They're working hard and hoping that one day their hard work pays off, and they have this future hope that someday all of these promises that God has given, that those will come true and everything will be good. But for now, you just day in, day out, do your work, live your life. So that's probably a bit of what Jesus walks into. So let's look at the story. In Luke chapter 4, verse 16, we're told that Jesus went to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up, and on the Sabbath he went, as usual, to the synagogue. He stood up to read the scriptures and was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah, and he unrolled the scroll and found the place where it's written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has chosen me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What a usual synagogue service would have looked like is not in some ways so different from the order of what we'll sometimes do in church here, where you start with a prayer and with some praise. And then they had a reading from the Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And then there was a reading from what they called the Haftorah, which was things like the prophets, like the book of Isaiah. And then there was what they called the Dvar Torah, which was sort of like the sermon, where after you've had these readings, then the guy can share a little bit about what these mean and what that is. So Jesus had gone into the synagogue that apparently had the reading from the Torah, and then Jesus is the one who gets to read the Haftorah, this part from Isaiah that it's very possible that it would have been picked for him, that there's a specific readings that you do for each week, and so that was the reading. Or maybe he looked at it himself, but then Jesus starts to read. Oftentimes we'll say that this comes from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. Which is, for the most part, true. But if you read Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, it's actually not exactly the same. There's a word that's taken out, there's a phrase that's put in, and then at this very end, Jesus kind of stops in mid-sentence or mid-phrase and doesn't finish off what's there. Why does he do that? Well, here's also a little more background. When someone was reading from the Torah, you could not change a word. If you change a word, you get in trouble. But when you read from the Haftorah, you could jump around a bit. You could leave a sentence out. You could even go a little bit forward or a little bit back. But how could they decide how that went? Well, the Torah and those books were all written in Hebrew, but the people speak Aramaic. So you have one man who reads in Hebrew and then one man translating. And if while the translator is translating, you can switch to the next part really quick, then it's okay. If you can't get to it in time, then, I don't know, it's not like Jeopardy where time's up, you have to stop reading. I'm not sure what they did to you if you couldn't make it in time, but the idea is during the translation you can move a little bit. So Jesus jumped forward, he went back into Isaiah 58, verse 6. And looking at this and studying for it, it reminded me of the first time that I was in Kenya. Christina and I had went on a mission trip, and we went with the local pastor out into this village, a Luo village, and we're in a church and I'm getting to preach. So I'm preaching in English and then it's being translated from English into Swahili. Then it's being translated by another man from Swahili into the Luo language. If you've ever been a speaker with a translator, you know that it kind of takes a little while to get from one to the other. Try it two times. I say something, wait a little bit, wondering, maybe I can run to the bathroom and get back in time while this is going on. I hope someone's getting lunch ready. Like, I speak to Swahili, to Luo. I speak to Swahili, to Luo. And I remembered that during the talk, I'm not sure which verse it was, but there was a verse that came to my mind that I went, oh, I would like to add that in this talk now, because I'm just sitting there with tons of mental time on my hands. but I didn't remember exactly where it was. I think I knew it was like, it's probably in Matthew, somewhere like 10 to 14. So I picked up the Bible, and I'm just searching through the Bible while they're still translating. Plenty of time, I'm like, oh yeah, there it is, Matthew 12 something, okay. And we're waiting. And then finally they got done and I could put that in. And that's what this kind of reminds me of, that as Jesus is speaking, he has a little bit of time during the translation that he can jump around and read a different part. And we're not sure that that was a definite practice at Jesus' time, but it was by a century or two afterwards, so it seems very possible that that's what Jesus would have been doing. But here's the thing. Why would Jesus edit some of the Bible verses? Why did he use some things and not other things? Why did he say parts and not? If you read through Isaiah 61 and read some of the other stuff, it starts like this. The Spirit's on me. He's called me to preach good news, to call freedom for the captives, stuff like that, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. But right after that, then becomes, and the day of vengeance of God on his enemies and the foreigners in our land, they're going to become our slaves, more or less, and you, the people of the land, will become rich off of these foreigners who start serving you, and they're going to tend to your crops, they're going to tend to your flocks, and they're going to build up your buildings. So why doesn't Jesus put in that part? Two quick reasons why I think that is. The why, number one, part of it had to do with timing. See, this was a prophecy about what will happen, but not all prophecies get fulfilled all at the same time. But sometimes there are things that get fulfilled earlier and then a fulfillment to come. And this was Jesus during what we call his first coming. Jesus is going to come back again. We believe it and we know it, that he will return. And during Jesus' first coming, when he came to speak, this is what he came to proclaim. That was his mission for his first coming. And some of the other things that would be in that prophecy, we're going to be part of his second coming. But Jesus is saying, this is what's here for right now. And so we're going to talk about what's right now. The second why has to do with the audience. If you're a good speaker, you'll consider your audience. You'll know your audience and know how to speak to them. Jesus did this, except in a way that you wouldn't expect. As I said, his audience is a group of guys in Nazareth. They're hardworking, they're poor. And for them, when they think about the Messiah coming, this great promise, they're looking forward to, this Messiah will come and all our hard work is going to pay off. We're finally going to get rich off of all of these foreign scum that we don't want in our land anymore. We've been working hard with our flocks. We've been working hard growing things. And these foreigners, they're going to take over and do all that. So when they would read Isaiah 61, that's probably the kind of stuff that they get really excited about. That's the promise that they're looking for. And if Jesus just wants to play to the crowd, then you just focus on the stuff that they want to hear. Jesus wasn't good at just doing what people wanted him to, though. And Jesus instead says, this is what's important about those verses, to proclaim freedom for the captives, that there's a year of the Lord's favor, that salvation is here, right now. It's not you looking for some far-off day when you're going to have all the things you want and your hard work is going to get paid off and all of the other foreigners that you don't like are going to get kicked out. It just isn't going in the direction that they want them to go. So how do they respond to this? Jesus rolls up the scroll, gives it back to the attendant, and sits down. And all the people in the synagogue had their eyes fixed on him as he said to them, "The passage of Scripture has come true today as you heard it being read." The first part, he rolls it up, gives it back, sits down. It's not like he's going to sit out in the crowd and he sits down so that he can talk to them, because then he's going to be speaking the wrong direction. So where is Jesus sitting when he says this? In most synagogues, as far as we would know from what it seems like archaeologically, there was this thing called the seat of Moses. It was going to be put in front of the synagogue. Because when a rabbi was going to speak, instead of like we do today where he stands up and either stands behind his podium to show that this is his time to speak, or he walks around like me because I have a hard time standing still, their leaders, they would sit, and a rabbi would sit so that he could speak. And that was showing that I'm now kind of in this place of authority to be speaking. So Jesus sits down in what's called the seat of Moses. It was also, if you know some of the history, Moses was this great prophet, and they're looking for a second person who's going to come in the same heart and spirit as Moses that's going to be able to speak to them and tell them all this great stuff. Well, Jesus sitting in that seat, they're understanding that Jesus is saying a lot about himself by sitting down there, and then his words match with it. He says, you know that verse I just read, Isaiah 61, this great prophecy about a Messiah that was going to come? Today, you heard it. Right now, that promise is fulfilled in my presence being here. Today, the promise is fulfilled in the presence of Jesus. But they don't necessarily see that way. So then, their response becomes this. All who were there watching and listening were surprised at how well he spoke. And they kept on asking, isn't he Joseph's son? And Jesus answered, doubtless you'll quote to me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. What we've heard you did at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well. And he said, truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. Depending upon which version of the English Bible you read, you'll actually get a little different picture, especially in that first verse or two, where it actually sounds like the people are happy. It says everyone spoke well of him, and they're looking at him in amazement, which can be a valid translation of it, but doesn't seem to fit the whole picture of what's going on. And that's why some of even the older English translations, like the King James or a few newer ones, are having this, where they start with a more neutral statement, just saying that they're watching and listening and they're surprised at what Jesus is saying and at how well that he speaks. That same word that's used for surprised there sometimes is used when Jesus is saying, I'm surprised at your great faith. It's also the same word he uses when he says, I am surprised at your little faith. I am shocked at how little you get this. And there are times where people are amazed at what Jesus is saying and they have the surprise. They seem happy. But there are other times where Jesus' enemies are trying to catch him in something. And then he comes up with this great thing to say that shuts them up. And they're surprised, but it doesn't mean they're happy. And so if your translation of the Bible makes it sound like they're happy, that is a possible translation, but I actually recommend, in this case, the ones that just show, these people are shocked going, Jesus has completely edited one of our favorite Bible passages, and he's left out all the good stuff. And then he sat down, and in this place of authority, and says, and by the way, I'm the best thing you got coming. That great thing you've been looking for? Yeah, that's me. That type of person who leaves out all of your favorite parts in the movie. But as he talks about this and he says, no prophet is accepted in his hometown, part of what he's saying is this, look, if you guys aren't going to want me, that doesn't change who I am. I'm still a prophet. I'm still speaking these right words. Their response is their own fault. And unfortunately, they weren't interested in the person of the Messiah. They were interested in the excitement of what was going to happen. All of this, I hope that you've seen as we go throughout our teachings, that it's not just we're trying to learn about what happened then, but see how it applies to our life now, how Jesus is our example. I know people who are really excited about faith, religion, Christianity. But it's not because they're interested in the person of Jesus. They're just interested in what they might be able to get out of it. They're interested about these great promises that they hope, if they work hard enough, someday that work will pay off and they'll get all the good stuff that's coming to them because they chose to be in the right religion. Jesus is wanting to point people to himself. And that's why, as this church, we say Jesus is our example. And we want to love as Jesus loved and teach what he taught and obey as he obeyed, because it's about the person much more than it's about the stuff. But Jesus wasn't done. So he goes on to use two stories that they would have known very well that are from the Old Testament. Both of them have to do with people who were Old Testament prophets. One guy, his name is Elijah, and then Elijah was the mentor of a guy named Elisha. And he says, hey, you guys like these prophets? How about these two stories and what this has to do with foreigners? Elijah lived during a time where there's a famine for 3.5 years. No rain. Stuff doesn't grow well when there's no rain. And Jesus said, you know, during that time, God sent Elijah into a city that was outside of the area of Israel, a place called Zarephath. As he enters the city, apparently he comes in the gate, and there's this widow who's picking up sticks. He says, I'm thirsty. Can you get me a glass of water? Yeah, I'll go get you some water. Hey, while you're at it, could you bake me like a little cake, a little piece of bread? And the woman looks at him and says, okay, you're not quite getting what I'm doing here. I'm a widow. My husband's gone. I have a little boy. We're in the middle of a famine, if you couldn't tell. And I got nothing left. So I'm picking up sticks here because I'm going to take those home and start a fire. And I'm going to take the last little bit of flour that I have and the last little bit of oil that I have. I'm going to make some food. My son and I, we're going to eat that, and then we're going to wait to die because we got nothing else. So I'll get you a glass of water. I don't got a lot of extra stuff to be feeding you, dude. All of us have hit on hard times. The other people in my city, they also don't have a lot to give to us. If I were Elijah, I'd almost feel like a jerk. I just asked this very poor widow who's wanting to give up on life if she could give me some food. But instead of apologizing, Elijah says this to her. Go home. Make me some food. Give it to me. Make whatever is left over for your son and for you. And I promise, during this drought, you will not run out of flour or of oil. That's pretty gutsy to say to somebody. But she does it. And for the rest of the drought, she and her son have food. Every day, there's flour. Every day, there's oil. And Jesus says, you know, at that time, there were plenty of poor widows who were inside of your land that were from your country. But God sent Elijah to this woman outside of your country who no one seemed to care about and no one was going to take care of. Oh, how about another story while I'm doing storytelling? Jesus goes on. He says, okay, or how about this one? Elisha, the prodigy, the guy who came after Elijah. At that time, they're out of the drought, so this is good. But there is a guy who is a general in a foreign army. He lived in Damascus, in the middle of Syria. So this man is rich, he's powerful, he's a general, and whether or not he's killed people individually, which he probably has, he has led men into war and plenty of other people have died, perhaps even Jewish people. But this general, he has a problem. He has a skin disease. Could have been leprosy, could have been something else. Back then, they didn't have all the fancy words for diseases that we have now. So he had some kind of skin disease, and he can't get rid of it. He just so happens to have a slave girl that says, hey, there's a guy over in Israel. He can heal you. And so he goes to his king and says, King, I want to go to Israel so I can get healed. King says, okay, sends him off. And eventually, this proud general, wealthy general, shows up at the door of the prophet Elisha. He's knocking on the door. And Elisha doesn't even come downstairs. He just sends the servant and says, go to the door. Answer it and tell this guy to just go to the Jordan River, dunk 7 times, you'll come out, you'll be clean. You're good, go home. So the servant goes down and tells this to the man, and the general of a foreign army gets ticked because he's expecting that he'll be at least treated with a little bit of respect, right? He's used to having some kind of form of decorum, and this man of God doesn't even come down and talk to me, he just sends a servant. And he tells me to go wash in your dirty, stinky river. And he says this, like, the Jordan? We have rivers back in Damascus that are a lot nicer than yours. Forget it. And he starts walking off, and he leaves. This man really should be thankful for his servants, because his servant runs after him and says, okay, General Naaman, come on. If you were asked to do some amazing feat, if you were like Hercules and you were being asked to do these 7 tasks to prove yourself to the gods, you'd do it, right? Yeah, of course I can. I'm a man. I'm a general. I can do stuff. He says, then why don't you just kill your pride, go in the water and do it? Stop whining like a baby and just obey him. I'm not sure if the servant said it quite that way, but he deserved it that way if he didn't. But he says, you would have done something amazing, right? So he says, fine. He goes to the Jordan River. He dips himself 7 times. He comes out, and he's healed. So he goes back, now really thankful, to the prophet's door. He's like, hey, let me give you all this stuff. And the prophet says, no, just go home. And Jesus, once again, gives a similar thing. You know, during the time of Elisha, there were plenty of other people who had diseases in Israel, but those didn't get healed. Instead, it's some foreign general. Jesus is attacking their theology, and they're not really liking it. Jesus is saying, all those people that you think weren't important enough, God apparently did find them important. Because if they had to be honest, and they were to look at that widow who had been in Zarephath and said, where was God when your husband died? He had more important people to deal with. Where was God when the father of her son died? God probably had more important people to deal with. Where was God when she was down to her last little bit of flour and the last little bit of oil? God probably had something more important to deal with. And even though they're not saying it, Jesus is showing that's how you really care about these people. That's how you actually feel about this, is that they are not important to God. The only way they fit into the scheme is where they become your slaves and servants. For us as people, there's kind of theology of mission that I think is important to see with Elijah and Elisha. With Elijah, we see that he goes out, he goes into another country to reach other people. With Elisha, we see other people will get attracted in. And in this church, I hope that we see both of those things continue and continue, where we send people out to tell about the good news of Jesus, and at the same time, we see people coming into this church that are getting to hear it. And we can't just be just one or the other. We're going out and we're attracting them in. But when we look at the two people, the widow and the general, they're about as far apart as you could get. One's a woman, one's a man. One's probably highly educated, one's not. One's got people around him who love him and servants who will help him out. And one is a widow who's got no one but her little boy who can't do anything for her. One of them has all the food, one of them has no food. One of them is probably a man known for his violence. He's a general. One of them is known for being on the side of society that can't do a whole lot. There's only two things those people had in common. Number one, they're a foreigner. Number two, God cared enough to do something in their situation. If you feel like an outsider, I hope that you'll know Jesus cares about your situation. So after Jesus has said all of this and has apparently made the people unhappy, how unhappy are they? Verse 28, when the people in the synagogue heard this, they were filled with anger. They rose up, dragged Jesus out of town, and took him to the top of the hill on which their town was built, and they meant to throw him over the cliff. But he walked out through the middle of the crowd and went his way. So Jesus has just questioned their theology, and they say, you know what? Service is over. We're not listening to any more. Stop the church service. Start a riot. They grab him, and they're taking him out to the edge of the hill that this was built in, because Nazareth was kind of built in the side of a hill that was sloping up. And often, throwing someone off of a cliff was just the first step in starting to stone someone. You first throw them off, then you throw stones on top of them. It works easier that way, because it goes down. These people were so angry at Jesus, they wanted to kill him. Jesus probably knew it walking in. He wasn't surprised that these people he had grown up around for about, let's say, 25 years, because at the beginning he wasn't in Nazareth, but he'd been around them for decades. He knew their mentality. He knew how they looked at Scripture, and he knew that they had it all wrong. And he wasn't about to just make them happy just to make them happy. That's why it's not really surprising in Matthew chapter 4 when we're told that Jesus, after finding out that John had been arrested and he returns to Galilee, he left Nazareth and decided to live in Capernaum. If a whole village wants to kill you, yeah, I'd move to another city as well. So I have three questions I want you to consider. And these are three questions. These are the perceptions that I think Jesus was fighting against. Number one, the perception of who is Jesus really? They thought Jesus is a local boy. We knew who Jesus' dad was. He grew up with Joseph and he worked around here. Yeah, this is Jesus. They were in some ways so close to him and so familiar with him that they completely missed who he was. And Jesus is saying, today, the promise of God is fulfilled in my presence, being here. Second question is, what is the promised good life? What is it that God has promised? This would be my question to you. If you, right now, could say, like, if God fulfilled all of the good promises he wanted to give you on this earth, what would that look like right now? And at the same time, if you were in heaven, what would that look like? What really is the good promises that he has given? And for them, they were thinking the good life is this. We are in control of our own land. All of the foreigners, they're either kicked out or they're our slaves. And we're getting rich off of their work. What do we think the promised good life is? And also, honestly, in our church, there are things I would love to see happen in our church where we have this, like, oh, it'll be nice when we have our own building. And that we can have our own space 24/7. Or, oh, it'll be great when we have 15 connect groups that are going throughout the city. It'll be great when we're getting to see more and more miracles happening every day. It'll be awesome when we get to see people who are getting baptized every week. Man, that'll be the good life then. And I'm not saying any of those things are wrong. But at the same time, I want to be someone who sees that I and our church have the promised good life now in the presence of Jesus. He's the fulfillment, not the other stuff that comes along with it. Because they were looking for miracles. He said, you know what, I bet you're going to say, you've been doing all this cool stuff other places. Why don't you do those miracles here? Because they want all the other stuff. And Jesus is saying, you know what, the first thing you need to see is that I'm the fulfillment of that promise. Is that the way you see it? Is that the way you live it? And then third is, what characteristics is God looking for? What kind of people is God looking for? Honestly, I think a bunch of us think, well, God just wants me to be a good person. And, you know, God wants me to make sure that I do the right things. And God probably likes people who are more from this background or that background, or maybe this skin color versus that skin color, or God wants us to have this kind of nationality or to know this many Bible verses. The things in the two stories of the widow and the general that we can see, or that I pick out, stuff that God is looking for, is people who will be obediently generous, even if they have nothing. Woman who had flour and oil, but she was willing to give when she was told this is what God is asking. And yet, at the same time, from this rich general who tries to give all his money, he says, no, I don't want it. So it's not just making sure that you're giving money, but that you're giving it according to what God is telling you, being obedient in that. Another one, especially with Naaman, the general, is he's looking for people who will be obediently humble. Someone who doesn't say, well, look at all the awesome stuff I can do. God says, this is what I'm asking you to do. in the general's case, go jump in the water. I don't care that it's dirty. Just do it. Sometimes I think there'd be more guys who would love to be Christians if God had said, you can become a Christian by going out and slaying a dragon or a giant or climbing the top of Mount Everest. You give a guy some kind of challenge of what cool thing he can do, and they're like, I'm all in. I can totally do it. I'm a man. But they're thinking, you know, if I can just do something, and instead, Christian life was never about if you could work hard enough for your hard work to start paying off. I get that mentality. I grew up, my dad was a farm kid, and so I get this idea of we should be hard workers. And I'm not saying we shouldn't. Jesus was, but Christian life is about what he gives by grace through faith. And sometimes we just have to be obediently humble and say, this is what God said, this is the way I'll do it, whether it looks cool or not. And obviously these people had faith because they actually followed through on the stuff that they were told. I think those are the things that God is looking for, and I'm sure there's more. But in your life, hopefully, Jesus today is challenging your perception of who he really is, of what actually is the good life that we're looking for, and of what kind of characteristics he's looking for. At the same time, are you able to look at your own culture and see where they might have got off course? Each culture will have something, trust me. Just like Jesus walking into his hometown in Nazareth. I'm not saying all of them are bad people, but they had things that they considered just part of this local culture, and this is what's right. And Jesus said, no, really look at it. There are some places where you have it wrong. And so whether you come from some place in North America or Europe or Africa or Asia, will you let Jesus be the one who shows you what is truth and not just follow your own cultural perception? So here's the Jesus Life Step for this week. I would challenge you to question either a coworker or a friend or a fellow student on their idea of the good life. To see what it is that they think. But be willing to challenge people. Be willing to actually get them to think, is the stuff I'm living for, is the good end that I'm hoping for, is that really what's the most important thing? Let's pray.